it was a really shocking and saddening moment, both in terms of the grief of losing him, but then even more so this, you know, reckoning of the blank and empty page, realizing how little I actually knew about so much of his life.
Welcome back to another episode of the Sunday Long Read Podcast. I'm Don Van Natta. You were just listening to the voice of author and historian Garrett Graff, our guest on this episode of The Art of Remembering, a series from the Sunday Long Read Podcast. As you likely know by now, this is a new version of the Sunday Long Read Podcast. You're listening to the fourth and final installment of our premiere four-episode season centering around a common theme. This first is about obituaries. We are sponsored by our friends at Airmail, your essential weekend read from Graydon Carter, former editor of Vanity Fair, and Alessandra Stanley of the New York Times. My guest this week is Garrett Graff. Garrett is a prolific magazine writer for publications including the New York Times, Wired, the Washington Post, and Bloomberg. He's the author of books about Watergate, 9/11, and cybersecurity. None of these experiences quite prepared him for what he recently had to write. On January 10th, he published an obituary of his dear friend and former colleague, Blake Hounshell. Garrett is with me to talk about it today. Thanks for being with us, Garrett.
My pleasure. I'm a longtime fan of the newsletter and podcast and happy to be a guest myself now.
Well, thanks again. Taped to a corner of your office bulletin board is a quotation from the British poet Blake Auden, and it's this one. In the end, it all comes down to this. There's never as much time as you think. It's a quote that's appropriate for our conversation today about obits, and more specifically, sudden obits that a writer must write on deadline about a colleague and a friend. Garrett, I want to start with this question. When did you tape that quote to your bulletin board, and why does it speak to you so much?
I taped it up at some point a year or two ago, and it is, for me, part of, sort of a larger reckoning that I feel like so I'm in my early 40s now, and at that stage where, you know, I'm beginning to sort of lose friends in the prime of their life to sort of weird, you know, diseases and accidents. And it has become for me a very important part of my sort of life belief system in the last couple of years that, you just never know how much time you have left, as an individual, but then also with the people that you love and cherish in your life.
Blake Hounshell was a dear friend of yours, Garrett. What do you remember about the first time you met him?
So Blake and I met when he and Susan Glasser, who was then the editor of Politico magazine, Blake was the deputy editor of Politico magazine, tried to recruit me to Politico in the summer of 2014. I first met Blake on the patio of a cafe in Washington, D.C. over lunch. And then I started at Politico a couple weeks later. And ultimately, when he and Susan got promoted later that year to take over all of Politico, I stepped in as the second editor of Politico magazine and, you know, worked very closely with Blake, on a daily basis, for a year there in that role. And then have continued writing for the magazine in the, 7 or 8 years since then. And so it sort of kept in touch with Blake. Although, and that's, part of this story, Not as closely as, in retrospect as I wish I had. I last spoke to him sort of at some point in the fall. He had moved over to be a columnist for the New York Times, writing their On Politics newsletter. And I, you know, spoke with him for some article he was working on at the time. And we had a, you know, very casual catch up about our respective lives, and then moved right into talking about work. And that was, as it turned out, the last time that I ever spoke to him.
Blake passed away on January 10th, 2023. What was that day like for you?
So I had gotten a text message from a friend at the Washington Post about 2:30 that afternoon saying that Blake's family had just released a statement saying that he had died that day after losing a longstanding battle with depression. And it was just a complete and utter shock, as those things are. And I immediately called one of my good friends who had taken over, you know, Blake's role and my role, and was now the editor of Politico magazine, Elizabeth Ralph, and talked with her for about 10 minutes. And then she called me back about 15 minutes later with Daphne Linzer, then the editor of Politico. And they asked me together to write Blake's obit, which was, of course, not anything that was anywhere on my radar, you know, 35 minutes earlier. And then, you know, I sat there with a blank Microsoft Word document and about 3 hours to try to figure out, you know, how to capture his life and, you know, learn what I could about his background and family and, you know, passions and professional accomplishments that I didn't already know. And it was a really shocking and saddening moment, both in terms of the grief of losing him, but then even more so this, you know, reckoning of the blank and empty page, realizing how little I actually knew about so much of his life. And, you know, this was someone that I had worked with closely, would have told you was a good friend. And yet, as I began to try to translate that, you know, series of memories into, you know, a concrete obituary, realized how fuzzy so much of the knowledge that I had about his background and professional life and, you know, the things that mattered most to him.
Garrett, you called the challenge of writing the tribute to Blake a tragic honor, but I'm struck listening to you describe it. It's an immense amount of pressure you're facing, not just because you haven't even had a moment to process the loss of your friend, but suddenly, as you say, you've got to get words down on that blank Microsoft Word page, and you're reckoning with that idea that, well, I don't know as much about my friend as I need to know. So you do what any reporter does, and you start making phone calls. Who was the first person you called, and how did you fill those 3 hours with so much incredible detail and wonderful, heartfelt writing about your friend in such a short amount of time?
Yeah, I think the pressure in a moment like that is particularly strange because, you know, I think one of the things that we always worry most about as journalists and writers is writing for an audience that knows more about the subject than you do.
Yes.
Any time I sit down and write history, there are going to be people who are reading it who know more about that history than I do. In some cases it's, you know, academic scholars. In some cases it's, subject matter experts. In some cases, it's the participants themselves. And that's always, to me, one of the hardest audiences to try to please in your sort of mental imagination as you write. This is a situation, though, where, you know, Blake was a huge presence in Washington journalism. He had worked at Foreign Policy and Politico and New York Times. He had hired and mentored, you know, an entire generation of young political journalists and, you know, foreign policy writers across Washington, both in journalism and at think tanks. And, you know, most of those people I know or am professionally aware of, you know, many of them are friends and peers myself. And so, you know, there was sort of this added layer of, oh God, like, how do I do this in such a way that I can do justice to my friend, but also do it well enough that all of the people that I know who are going to read this and know Blake as well are going to see him in it, see him captured in it, and feel that it, you know, accurately told the story of his life as best one can. And Blake is someone who, you know, and this was one of the defining aspects of my obituary, you know, was one of the very online journalists of early Twitter. Had this immense following on Twitter, knew an incredible number of people online. And so I started sort of two reporting threads immediately. One was, you know, calling former Politico colleagues who I knew him and had worked with him and known him as a friend to ask for their memories and details. And then also looking online on Twitter for people who were sharing memories of him. You know, this was a big news event in the small world of Washington Twitter journalism. And so, you know, over the course of that afternoon, there were hundreds of memories from people who had worked with him or been mentored by him or been edited by him.
What was it like going through that outpouring of support, the stories and threads of people? And was it difficult for you in making choices on settling the stories that you wanted to share in the obit?
Yeah, to me, you know, again, what was so strange about this was Blake was a friend. And so part of staring at that blank Microsoft Word document, part of talking to everyone that I talked to in that period was it just kept coming up, all of these questions that I wished I had ever asked him. You know, things that I wish I had learned about him. And, you know, I think that some of that set of questions is similar to what most of us experience anytime we lose someone close to us, right? You know, when you lose, you know, a grandparent or a relative and suddenly realize, you know, all of the family history that is now closed off to you forever, you know, has been lost with that person's passing. And, you know, I've very acutely felt that with Blake in his life of, you know, I knew that he had gone to the Middle East after college graduation, and worked in Egypt, and met his wife in Egypt. But, you know, I didn't know that much about what he had done during that period. I didn't know what had drawn him over there. You know, I had never talked with him about, as it turned out, you know, some of the most important chapters of his entire life. And that was a really hard and humbling experience. Because, you know, as you're going through each of these interviews and talking to people, you're learning all of these sides and facets and details of someone that you, you know, at least in my case, I immediately wanted to turn around and talk to Blake about, you know, these sort of, you know, those 90 minutes could have generated, you know, days of further conversation with Blake about his life and, you know, why he did the things that he did and why certain things mattered to him, among others. And so, you know, it was a reporting process that was equal parts enlightening and frustrating at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What was the most surprising or interesting thing you discovered that afternoon about Blake's life?
Well, you know, when I talk about, like, never having talked with Blake about the most important chapters of his life, I had known Blake best during a period where he was just starting to have kids and I didn't have kids yet. And, you know, we were working in, you know, the sort of madhouse hours of Politico, and we didn't talk that much about anything outside of life. And so, or anything outside of work, I mean. And so, you know, that afternoon, as I'm reporting this, you know, I'm learning all about Blake as a dad and learning about his relationship with his kids. And as a dad now myself, you know, I have a new appreciation for how much that mattered to him and, you know, how much joy he got out of those experiences. And, you know, I probably hadn't spent 30 total minutes in our friendship talking about, you know, his kids and his life as a dad.
Airmail is the sophisticated digital weekly dispatch from Graydon Carter and Alessandra Stanley. The premise of Airmail is simple. Imagine the weekend edition of a no longer in existence international daily. Airmail features articles on subjects both foreign and domestic, ranging from politics and the environment to art and literature, style and fashion, high-end crime, and beyond, by some of the world's finest journalists. For the most part, these are stories you will not find anywhere else. Airmail's weekly issue is delivered to your inbox on Saturdays at 6 a.m., making for a delightful and informative weekend read. And Airmail has recently launched Look, a beauty and wellness monthly issue edited by Allure founder Linda Wells, offering deep thoughts on superficial matters. We've featured numerous Airmail articles in the Sunday Long Read in the past, and we've decided to partner with Airmail to offer you a free 30-day trial. You'll receive Airmail's newsletters and get access to their content for 30 days, after which you can decide if you'd like to subscribe. Go to airmail.news/signup to sign up for your free trial. Again, that's airmail.news/signup. Sign up is all one word. One of your final paragraphs of the postscript, as it's called, as you talk, you know, very personal terms about Blake's life, talking about conversations and long dog walks with him was likely to range from topics like Henry Adams to the rapper Tyler, the Creator, from weightlifting podcast to Generation Z's political affiliations, which was the subject of one of his final columns the Friday before his death. You talk about his astute cooking skills. And it's a deft personal touch that you don't often see in obituaries. And I felt there that I was sensing more your personal relationship with him. Is that right? Is that a right instinct I have?
The irony is that those were actually almost all details from others.
Really? Wow.
That I gathered that day. That I, you know, and that was one of the questions that I was putting to everyone was, you know, what do you remember he liked and didn't like? You know, what would have surprised people about Blake? What do you remember talking with him about? And I sort of, you know, wound all of that up into those final couple of paragraphs. But the, you know, that again was, and this is true, right, of a lot of obits. And this is the challenge, I think, of trying to capture a life where, you know, my obit was, you know, 90% professional. And, you know, then at the end, you know, I throw in the, you know, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs of his, you know, family and personal life and personal interests and hobbies and things like that. But that's not the life that most of us live. You know, even those of us who live a vocation, you know, as a writer or as a journalist, you know, that's really important to us professionally, 50% or more of our life, if not 80% of our life, is not the things that take place in our workplace. And in obit, you end up with this, you know, very weird balance where, you know, you can spend, you know, paragraph after paragraph talking about someone's job and then, you know, in a final sentence be, you know, he's survived by, you know, his 2 children whom he loved very much. And, you know, that's wrapping a lot up into parentheses about someone's life in a way that is nowhere near an accurate reflection of how they actually viewed their own place in the world.
Yeah, and it's interesting you speak about parentheses because in your Substack, you quote John Irving, actually.
Yes.
The great novelist with this great quote that I want to read to our listeners. What is hardest to accept about the passage of time is that the people who once mattered the most to us wind up in parentheses. And then you go on to write, I know I missed and never knew some of the most important moments of Blake's life. And obviously, as we've been talking about, that was the great challenge. And I'm assuming that was the hardest part.
Yes.
Right? Garrett was trying to figure that out and you only had 90 minutes to do it. You have a remarkable amount of experience writing about tragic events and digging up new information and perspectives on topics. And as you said earlier, you keep reporting until you get bored or until you keep hearing things. I have a similar approach to my work as an investigative reporter as well. I over-report and always am feeling that there's something I don't know or that I didn't find out. Did you feel that you drew from that sort of toolbox as you were writing this piece that afternoon in such a hurried state?
Yeah, I had. I do not have a ton of experience writing obituaries. I regularly wrote obituaries on the college newspaper 20 years ago, and had gotten at least some training back then in the form of obituaries, you know, sort of how you do it, the things you're trying to ask and write for. And then, of course, I am a religious consumer of obituaries as a writer and as a journalist and as a historian. You know, the lives that the New York Times obituary page captures and tell are incredible. And, you know, again, you read about these people and you're like, oh my God, like I would so love to meet that person. And then, you know, realize, of course, you know, by definition, those are the one people you can't actually interact with in the newspaper. And then I had gone through, a similar experience actually in January 2021 with, and this is not unrelated to the posting of that Blake Auden quote that you mentioned on my bulletin board, where you know, part of my work is with the Aspen Institute, as you mentioned, and I had lost one of my best work colleagues there in January 2021 to pancreatic cancer in just 17 days. You know, pancreatic cancer is just a bear of a disease, as you know, most listeners probably know. And she was diagnosed on New Year's Eve and had died January 16th, and had, you know, some of the same sort of sense of sudden loss and trauma that, you know, I feel in Blake's death back then. And, you know, she had called me the first Monday after New Year's at 9 a.m., you know, first moment of the workday, to tell me that she had been diagnosed. And we spoke twice more that week, and then texted once as she was leaving the hospital the following week to go home to rest for her final hours at her apartment in D.C. And then I sat down and, you know, wrote with one of my other work colleagues, her obit for our staff, you know, to go out as sort of the all staff newsletter, and had all of the same feelings of, you know, all of these important moments of her life wrapped up in parentheses that I didn't know and would now never know. And it's, you know, to me, just this incredible ache in losing a friend and then being, then trying to translate their life into words and realizing as a journalist how hard that is and how little you actually know, how little concrete you often know about some of the people that you're actually closest to.
And you write about that, Garrett, in such a beautiful way on your Substack. You talk about the loss of your Aspen colleague, Savilla Pitt, and compare it to Blake's death, and you write, "Both experiences were critical reminders. Tell your friends that you love them, yes, but more than that, pester them with questions. Ask them directly about their backgrounds, their life dreams, their goals, what's motivated them, what success looks to them. Try to understand why they're who they are." And I was blown away when I read that this morning. It's such a great lesson. It's such a great directive for all of us. Be more curious. Ask those questions now when we can. And, you know, we're so busy and we just often don't. And it's something, you know, that we should absolutely try to do.
Yeah. And for me, I think, you know, if there's any lesson in such, you know, pointless tragedy, that's what I'm hoping that I take away from this in, you know, the months and years ahead, is, you know, to try to be a better friend such that I can, you know, just know my friends better in a way that, again, I would tell you that I think I know them well, and then when you are confronted with the blank Microsoft Word document of trying to write an obituary, suddenly a lot of the details are real squishy in your mind.
Was it cathartic to write this? How did you feel when you were done?
It's funny that you say that, because I said to a friend later that night, after the obit published of Blake, that it was really nice that afternoon to be able to have business conversations with a lot of, you know, our friends and, you know, colleagues and peers, you know, that I would be able to, that I was able to talk to a lot of people that I care about, you know, people who cared about Blake, and we were able, you know, in the reporting process to move past the, awkwardness of trying to talk about grief and loss and into, you know, what journalists do well, which is, you know, immediately move, you know, through trauma into reporting mode. And in a way that actually, you know, you talked about my 9/11 book and research there. One of the things that I talk about when I talk about journalism is my own experience on 9/11. And part of that was I was so grateful amid that tragedy in 2001 to be a journalist because it gave me something to do that day. I wasn't just sitting on the couch watching and worrying. You know, I got right up and went into the newsroom and, you know, spent the entire day reporting and writing and amid other people reporting and writing. And, you know, having in some ways that structure amid tragedy was a really important part for me of coping that day. And I sort of felt that same weird reaction on the day that Blake died of, okay, I had a minute or two of grief and surprise and sorrow here and now need to move into reporting mode and call these people who, you know, in some cases I would want to have tried to talk to that afternoon anyway, and, you know, be able to call them up and say, okay, let's move past our grief in this moment and let's talk about Blake and, you know, help me pull this together and, you know, let's do this together and I need your help.
Yeah, the task becomes a distraction from the grief.
Yes.
Right? An essential one. I had a similar experience, Garrett. I heard the plane hit the Pentagon from my house in Alexandria, Virginia.
Wow.
I heard the crash. My daughter, who was only 1.5, was in a park about 1/4 mile away with our nanny. And I ran full tilt, scared to death about whether she was safe or not. And she was happily on a swing where I found her, got home and did the same thing. Went to work and
yep.
ran around and visited hospitals in the Washington, D.C. area and wrote the story about the plane hitting the Pentagon for the New York Times. And you have no time to think about and process. You just have a job to do. I'm assuming that those conversations you had with Blake's friends and colleagues that afternoon, it almost becomes like an instant wake, right? And a sort of
yes.
celebration of his life, because in a way, the fact that there were so many gaps that you needed to fill again is a distraction from that grief. And did it work that way?
I think it did. And it was, it gave, I think that this is true, you know, of almost anyone that you're interviewing for an obituary, whether as the writer you knew the person or not. You know, my experience in writing obituaries as I have done them is they're this wonderful gift in some ways that you get to give the world of, calling people up and asking them, you know, tell me about this person that you worked with or loved or hated or knew or were influenced by, and, you know, tell me how they changed your life, how they changed the world, how you think that they would want to be remembered. I have very rarely ever, when I have been calling to ask someone for memories of someone who has passed away, found that someone wouldn't want to talk, because, you know, it is this way that you are able to help keep someone's memory alive for future generations and future readers.
The subheadline on your obit, Blank Hounshell, love great scoops, pithy framing, and a sharp tweet. In fact, he would have made this headline much better. I love that.
There's a funny story about that headline as well, which is I live in Vermont. I was in Vermont that day. People, you know, Blake's colleagues and his family had gathered in D.C. that night, and including the Politico leadership. And they sort of wrote that headline, you know, all together standing in a kitchen, you know, crouched over a laptop. And, you know, Blake probably would have been impressed at the sheer journalistic intellectual firepower that went into writing his headline, all of which together was less brilliant than the headline that he would have come up with himself.
How did his family react to your piece?
They were very grateful. His father came up to me at Blake's memorial service and said how grateful he was for it. And, you know, I think the thing that really sort of stuck with me in the writing process that was the hardest is knowing, you know, Blake has two young kids, and, you know, knowing at some point that they will sit and read that obit and that it will be, you know, one of the ways that they learn about their dad later in life. You know, that was something that really, really stuck with me in the course of the writing.
Well, it's a incredible gift you've given them. You've got to take a lot of pride in that, for sure.
So,
Garrett, thank you so much for being with us today. I've greatly enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for helping to remember Blake and talk about, you know, what to me is always one of the most fascinating pages in the newspaper or in journalism.
Thanks again. Next up on the Sunday Long Read podcast, humor. We'll delve into the very difficult job of humor writing. We'll go from death notices to finding ways to make us laugh. Our next season, it's coming soon, will bring you four fabulous humorists, all of whom are some of the top humor writers working today. Subscribe to the Sunday Long Read podcast on Spotify or Apple to make sure you don't miss a single season or even one episode. This episode was produced by Atreya Verma, Etienne Lejoie, Alex Fuse, and Jacob Feldman. The Art of Remembering is a series from the Sunday Long Read podcast, an audio extension of the Sunday Long Read. Every Sunday, we curate our favorite long-form journalism in a newsletter that drops into your inboxes bright and early. Our members get the newsletter even earlier. Our Bulldog Edition drops in their inboxes at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Saturday night. You can subscribe or become a member at www.sundaylongread.com. I'm Don Van Natta. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us for Season 2 on humor, coming soon to the Sunday Long Read podcast. See you soon.